You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
On this week's Lyric Feature, we tell the story of the actor Constance Smith and the various monuments to her which have begun to appear around her native Limerick. Connie Gets a Rewrite is presented by Sharon Slater.
Constance Smith won.
Well, Miss Smith, we know that for the last couple of days you've been travelling with Paul Rosa. Really, through what is known as the Frank O'Connor country, with a view to making a film called Jumbo's Wife.
That is true, yes.
Is this your first time working with Mr. Rosa?
It is, yes.
And you're looking forward to it?
Yes, I think through him I will be able to tell my story. See, I was born in County Limerick, but it is now called Wolfstone Street. And the Jumbo's Wife will show the country as it was.
I'm Sharon Slater. I'm a historian here in Limerick. And today we're going to be wandering around in the footsteps of Constance Smith, Connie, as she was known to her friends. She was a starlet in the 1950s. And to me, she's like my aunt now at this stage from the amount of research that I've done on her. But she had an amazing life, one that's almost forgotten, and it's lovely to see her coming back into the fore. So we're going to walk through the park. Everybody in Limerick has gone through the park, the People's Park in Perry Square, and we know that Connie definitely would have come through here, or at least been pushed when she was a baby, because she only lived around the corner. So you can imagine her with the big old-fashioned prams, huge wheels, her mother pushing her along. And most of these trees would have been there at the time. Some of them are, you know, 150 years old. So they were definitely here when Connie was a baby. I began researching Constance Connie Smith over 2 decades ago, back about 2003, just after Connie died, when I first saw a copy of an old Limerick Leader article talking about a movie called The Golden Condor and starring a Limerick-born actress with the name Constance Smith. I'd never heard of her before, and I wasn't the only one. Back then, she wasn't widely known. Really, she wasn't known at all. But just this week, there is a ceremony in People's Park to install a star for Connie. And as you'll find out during our walk today, that's not the only monument to Connie springing up in Limerick. So let's walk this way. Another monument to the city is a live one, a brand new show on the life and afterlife of Constance Smith. It's called Connie, as those who loved her would have called her. And today, at locations around Limerick we're going to visit, sets are being built, lines are being learned by the woman who'll play Connie on the stage, even an orchestra rehearsing the brand new soundtrack. And everywhere, tears are being shed as Limerick gets ready to tell the real story of Connie Smith.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to day one of rehearsals for Connie. Yay! We're so excited. My name is Joanne Ryan. I'm the producer and co-writer and co-creator of Connie, along with my very good friend and colleague, Anne Blake. Can't tell you how proud I am to be presenting Connie. Myself and Anne have been working on it on and off for almost 6 years now. And it's been an amazing journey, and we're so proud and delighted to be at this point. And really looking forward to making Connie.
The audience arrives to the Limerick Athenaeum, now known as the Royal Theatre, or the Theatre Royal. In its glory days as the Royal Cinema, it is Limerick, October 1953, and the night of the first Limerick screening of a Hollywood film starring Constance Smith. The bright lights above the entrance in the original cinema light box read Connie. Audience members exchange their bookings.
First, there's all the newspapers and magazines that told about her life. But as we know, newspapers and magazines, they all have their own biases. So it's a case of judging them against themselves and against each other to find out where the actual facts were. And then going back to sources, you know, like certificates of marriage, to look at all the different points together. And it's when we see them merge that we might find the grain of truth that's hidden in them all. Because with Connie's story, the amount of different times that I found, you know, she was born in Limerick, she was born in Dublin, she was born in Ardnacrusher, she was born in England. It's a case of where is this grain? Because there's parts of her story that were being picked up by different journalists, and they all heard what they wanted to hear to be able to put it into their papers. And then I got to know her family, and this is one of her neighbours. We're talking about Connie Smith. Oh. So they're from Wolfetone Street. I've done a lot of work with the people on Wolfetone Street as well. We went up and we gave talks and things to try and get the people in the street to know more about her as well, because they would be walking past her house every day and not realise that they're walking past the house of somebody who was so important, you know, at her time. You know, she was a huge star at her time.
Mm-hmm. You see, my father worked on the Shannon scheme. My mother was a Limerick woman. And I left Limerick when I was 2 years old. I had relatives in Ardnacrusher. I went back last Christmas, and I've tried to find the so-called cottage of Ardnacrusher. There was just one sign saying, go left to Ardnacrusher, and the other saying, go right to Ardnacrusher. But when I got there, there was nothing, only the cows. There was only a roadway.
Getting back to what you've been doing for the last couple of days.
My name is Michael John McCarthy. I am the co-composer and orchestral arranger on Connie, and we're at the recording session with the Irish Chamber Orchestra.
Are we good to go, Dave?
At the University of Limerick. You know, it's hard to speak about Connie, I think, without finding oneself sort of reaching for certain kinds of cliches around someone who's troubled. But I do think to have travelled the distance that she travelled is really quite extraordinary, and to have done so against incredibly challenging, abusive circumstances, particularly as a woman in that industry, in those industries at that time. For her to have achieved what she achieved, given where she was coming from, the background she was coming from, what she was up against when she got there, is really rather extraordinary. And I think what Anne and Joanne are doing in terms of reclaiming her story, I would hope that creatively, you know, that as a story in and of itself, that there would be a lot that people would get from it. But I think also just as an act of sort of history, in terms of reclaiming history or retelling history, reshaping history to bring in those voices that have been overlooked or erased, I think that's one of the most compelling aspects of the entire project.
So why we're walking up to this cathedral is because this is where Sylvester and Mary, Connie's parents, got married. They got married in, you know, the biggest cathedral, which is quite, you know, it would have been a lot of money to get married in the cathedral. There were different churches that people would get married in around the city, but they decided to get married in the Roman Catholic cathedral. I don't know if they've got masks or not. So once you come in here and you see how imposing this scene would have been, and the two of them going up this altar to get married. The thing was, this was October 1928, and Connie was born in January of 1929. And if anybody's any good at maths, they might know that doesn't quite match up. So I'm not sure if Mary quite had a waddle on her at that stage, but she definitely was probably showing. I'm not sure how the priest would have taken that, but he definitely gave his blessing, and the two of them were married that day and then went off for their probably breakfast. On their marriage certificate, it said that both of them were going to be 21 on their next birthday, because the age to The legal age for everything in Ireland at the time was still 21, so they hadn't quite reached adult age, so they couldn't put down of full age on the marriage certificate. It was age 21 and next birthday.
You really do find yourself going the extra mile, and I have pulled some night shifts and some early morning shifts to get the scores ready for the session today. And of course, you know, we're doing it partly because it's our job, but you do, the love for it, I suppose, you do find yourself, the love for it is infectious. And you just, yeah, you do find yourself wanting it to be the very best it can be. And I suppose also, even in the session today, it's very expressive work. The writing is very expressive. I think it really is asking an audience, encouraging an audience to go on an emotional journey. And I think such is the nature of Anne and Joanna as collaborators and as leaders of the project that you can't help but get swept up in the emotional aspects of that.
So when Connie was about 16 years old, when she was a teenager, she was up in Dublin and she was working in a chip shop. She had gone to a convent school up there. She had a rake of younger siblings, so she had to leave school to do that. But this is the 1940s. People didn't tend to stay on in school beyond primary school level anyway. And there was this lookalike competition that was constantly run by the Picture Goer magazine, by different entertainment magazines. We constantly have lookalike competitions. You know, there wasn't a lot of entertainment that you could have, so this was one that they did. So they held an event in a hotel in Dublin, and in it they got all kinds of lookalikes. So there was people there who would be lookalikes for Danny Kaye, people there who'd be lookalikes for Mickey Rooney, for Judy Garland. And Connie's mother told her to go along to this. She asked her, she ended up getting borrowing clothes from friends. She didn't have clothes to go in. And she went in to enter as a lookalike for Hedy Lamarr. And Hedy Lamarr, now we know her for the two aspects of her life, was being an actor, but also being a computer genius. Anyway, Connie went in to be a lookalike for Hedy Lamarr, and she absolutely was. She had that same dark hair, she had the same focus, the same sort of eyebrow ridges. So she won her round in the competition. There are multiple competitions on the same day, different people won. And one of the prizes that she won was to get her headshots and to go over for a test with Rank Studio. So she went and went for her test, and they asked her to stay on and to become a Ranks girl. There was lots of Ranks girls. The different studios who had their films in the same theatres, they would often send around these girls to drum up support for the movies that they were going on. So at first she was going around to different cinemas and standing outside the front going, "I'm a Ranks girl, don't you want to see the movies that's going on in here?" Not that she was in the movie, but her and some other very pretty young women would be doing this. And they would go to different places around the country to try and drum up support for people to go to the Ranks Studios films. And then she ended up starting to get her bit roles in the films itself after she went through the Ranks Studio charm school. It was called a charm school, where they taught them how to be poised, how to walk properly, how to wear appropriate clothing, how to do their makeup, how to change their accent. Because she at this stage would have had, you know, a Dublin accent, a lilting Limerick Dublin accent. It was very Irish anyway. So it was a case of trying to tone that down to the mid-Atlantic to try and get her more palatable to the wider audience's ears. That absolutely worked because she was picked up then by Fox Studios. The other people wanted her. She got that tone right. You can still occasionally hear her Irish accent coming through at different points in different films, but she knew how to put on that mid-Atlantic plain pronounce all your T's properly. Make sure there's a H in their accent when she was doing her movies.
So at 9 o'clock on Saturday night, I got a message, quick cached. What would Mary have used to chastise 14-year-old Connie in the context of calling her a whore? Well, not that word, etc. So then I responded with the word that she would have used would have been hussy. It was a very popular time in the 1940s. And was like, ah, yes. Would she have said prostitute, slut, tart as well? And I was like, no, a strumped up hussy, tart for sure, but not so much prostitute. Streetwalker used to be used as well in Painted Lady. Strumped up hussy altogether? Yes, strumped up hussy. Yes, altogether, or strumpet and hussy separately. And that's the kind of conversation that I would have with the co-creators. I'd get these messages at all hours when they had a spark of a thought. But see, now I knew Connie so well and her life, it was easy for me to answer it.
Also at the Irish Chamber Orchestra recording session, for the music of their production of Connie are Joanne Ryan and Anne Blake.
My name is Anne Blake. I'm the co-creator, composer and director of Connie. We just finished recording It's Time, which is the finale. And it's the final moment of the show when Connie has been brought on quite a harrowing journey. And it's a moment of closure, but it's a moment of hope and special moment for the audience as well.
Once again, there are tears. There will always be tears.
I just think it's so beautiful. Yeah, it's gorgeous. That's amazing to hear it like this. Anne was just reminding me there that she wrote it when we were in Ennis Diamond together working on the show. When was that? 2 years ago?
It was just around the time. It was just around the time Sinead O'Connor died.
Yes, it was the day, actually. Yeah, because the day we were on our way to the, we were in Tesco doing our shop for the residency, and I got a text from a friend to say that Sinead O'Connor had passed away. So it was that weekend, and her passing actually really informed the work, actually, because we realised that month there was so many resonances between Sinead and Connie. And over that weekend, Anne wrote the piece. But it's incredible to hear it like this. You know, it was always beautiful, but like this is... Yeah, amazing. Very powerful.
I have an extra... Well, I think we both have... resonances. We both have lost our mothers in the last recent years, and you know, this is a lullaby moment between a mother and a daughter. And as well, and my mother played the viola and the violin in the RT Concert Orchestra when she was younger. So this today is very, very emotional because in a great way, I'm feeling close to her.
Are we good, Dave?
Okay.
Music for the play is quite varied in some ways. The heart of it, I would say, are two songs written by Anne Blake, and the songs are beautiful, melodic. One of them is Stay at Home, is a setting of a poem, is very much a lullaby. The other is called It's Time, and it's from the point of view of Constance Smith, and it's a kind of a summing up and a release at the end of the play. So those are both very, very melodic songs.
Yeah, so I mean, when we are... is it a bad thing if it hangs over a bit?
We also veer into sort of 50s, late 40s, early 50s jazz territory. So we're doing a setting of a very obscure song from a film called Impulse. The song is called You're Gone, written by Stanley Black. And as far as we can tell, the only recording in existence of it is the recording in the film. I've searched in vain for any other recordings, so we've done an instrumental setting.
Not completely, like, yeah. Okay, let's listen to you and we'll do what you do.
Just copy up.
Exactly.
There's another piece we're doing, which is sort of a jumping off from Anne's song, taking the first line of that, but taking it for a bit of a walk into more sort of atonal territory for some of the sort of more difficult or troubling moments in Connie's story, and that's called I Want to Go Back.
The sort of Hollywood scary movie one was very interesting. I am Andrei Swanepoel. I'm in the Irish Chamber Orchestra. What happened after the war, or during the Second World War, is that a lot of people immigrated, amongst others Stravinsky and Schoenberg, who lived very close to each other in L.A. And also a lot of instrumentalists, probably a lot of the finest instrumentalists, mostly with Jewish heritage, ended up on the West Coast in America. Also, I mean, composers like Korngold, like Waxman, ended up there and wrote a lot of film music. So the whole Hollywood thing is very much a continental shift towards Hollywood. I mean, Schoenberg wrote this amazing sextet called the Verklärte Nacht, which is sort of an early Schoenberg piece, very romantic. And his favorite approved recording was made by the Hollywood String Quartet with some friends. But the Hollywood String Quartet was basically people that lived in Vienna that had moved to. And I mean, there's a certain style of playing which, yeah, I mean, you can't really, it has this Hollywood kind of, I mean, it's amazing, the playing. We've also, in the chamber orchestra, we've played a bit of Psycho. We've played quite a lot of film music, sort of the Psycho suite, the Bernard Herrmann suite, we've played a few times. And it's sort of the same vein, sort of, yeah. It's the tonal language, or the not tonal language, strange intervals. And strange chords, so strange harmonies that don't really make sense, and then sort of strange chords, and then I mean also the way you play the notes, like in this one, I think we did the really loud dissonant bit, we sort of played really long and sustained, and then there was one chord where we used a lot of vibrato to make it extra make it scary.
Just, you know, an all-women cast and a lot of the crew being women as well. Pretty much every single woman has been put into situations not as bad as what Connie went through at different points, but we've all been put into situations like that. So there is an empathy for her to see where our own lives could have veered into the same direction, the same troubles and traumas that she had to bear and go through. It's a very tangible, real thing for most women. And so everybody feels that and they feel it in their core.
God! What is it now, Miss Smith?
Well, it's these lines. They don't make any sense.
I'm Pom Boyd and I'm here in the Bell Table rehearsal space rehearsing for the role of Connie Smith. In the new production, Connie.
Yes, she's a dying woman. It wouldn't be fair.
And this is me, trapped in here like a mole, the blinds drawn all day, locked up in this apartment?
I'm here to play Connie Smith.
But I can't bloody leave, though, can I?
It's not my fault that you're Constance Bloody Smith. The press are obsessed with you.
Who was the actress originally from Limerick. She was quite a famous movie star, but most people have never heard of her. So the point of this project is to, well, it's a play, it's a show, to tell the story of her life and to bring her back to Limerick. What struck me was her integrity as a performer and her authenticity and her refusal, and this was her difficulty, this was part contributed to her downfall, her refusal to participate in the shallow, meaningless tropes that she was being asked forced into, basically. So she stood firm and she wouldn't change her name, and she refused to sleep with the directors, to, you know, which cost her her career. But she had so much integrity and depth to her performance.
You think you're in charge? You can get the hell out of my office. Do you hear me? Don't any of you touch me! I am not staying around in this cesspit. I quit.
You quit? How can you quit when I already fired you? You're finished. You're nothing.
It's actually something that's very close to my heart. It's it's a very common trope that happens to particularly female actresses, as they were known. Someone who has been thrust into the limelight, whose talent has been spotted, whose beauty has been spotted, and who, because of refusal to play the game, is then driven, cast out by the powers that be, by the patriarchy, if you like. And because of that, their life goes off the rails, and the usual classic booze and pills and personal tragedy and an inability to actually have relationships that are not traumatic, that are not full of conflict, that are not destined to fail and bring unhappiness. I feel a great empathy with Connie. I feel any woman understands this. Her path in lots of ways, and also recognizes it. I don't recognize it from my own life, but I do recognize it from my own parents, my aunties. My own mother was an actress. You know, she was spotted when she was 18. She was very talented. This was in the 40s, and she wasn't able for the sexism and the misogyny, and she called it out. And you can imagine for a woman, an 18-year-old woman calling it out back in 1948, 1950, whatever, that didn't go down too well. So her own career was thwarted.
Don't forget, darling, tomorrow you're gonna be a star. Ladies and gentlemen, let's all honour the inventor of the iconic casting couch, which has facilitated the systematic rape and abuse of thousands of young women.
Please, put your hands together for Daryl F. Zanuck.
Terrible thing is, when you're young, you don't listen to your mother's stories and you're not interested. And so my mother used to tell us all this stuff, but it was only when she, sadly, when she died that I started trying to piece it all together and become really interested in it. So my mother's name was Bernadette Leahy, and we have pictures of her when she was 21, 20, on the cover of Dublin Life magazine when she was the rising star. And the men, from my mother's recollection, were brutal and used to treat the women really badly and refer to them as cows. And so there was a lot of brutality that went on. Anyway, I think there was perhaps, maybe she, because she was young and she was the ingenue, she was being given all these parts that she didn't feel ready. She wanted to hone her craft, and she opted out and went in the middle of a tour, and she just came home, which was unheard of. I think it's probably why, for me, it was drummed into me that you never walk off stage, no matter how hard you're struggling. You keep going with the tour. You never let the show down. But she had no. She did that, and she came home and she went to bed, and had what we were told was a nervous breakdown. So that was the end of it for a while. But she did make a film after that in England called My Hands Are Clay.
Hey, you're in.
I love you. Will you marry?
What's that, Mary? What's that?
But when I saw her performing as a 22-year-old, I was blown away, and I was really struck. And there's parallels with Connie as well, of the depth in her and her integrity. And she had this beautiful voice. And it reminded me of Connie's, and the way people spoke back then. And I was really struck. I thought, oh, no wonder she was so full of regret, because to have that talent and not to have had it realized, it's a tragedy. So I decided to make a show because I thought I wanted it to look at my own shame, because I realised shame was something that I had carried with me my entire life without even being aware of it. I had inherited my mother's shame. So she had shame about that film that she made, which, when it was screened in the Savoy Cinema on O'Connell Street in Dublin, apparently in her mind, and I think this is true, I don't know, obviously it was her memory of it, when the scene that she, where the director had asked her to turn to the camera and smile, and she didn't want to. She felt the smile was completely wrong, and her artistic instincts were telling her, screaming, no. He made her do this. And when it was screened in the Savoy Cinema, and she turned to the camera, you know, it was full screen of her head smiling, the whole cinema apparently burst into laughter. And she died. She absolutely died with embarrassment. And never, that's all I ever heard about that film, was this shaming moment. And so I thought that was something really interesting to examine and to heal. And that was what the show was. It was we performed a ritual at the end where the audience got to throw toilet rolls up at the stage with their shame and leave their shame behind them in the theatre for that little moment, at least. I mean, I don't want to give away the show, but there will be a ritual in the show of reclaiming Connie and bringing her back. I don't know what she would have thought of all this. She probably, you know, she would probably be quite disparaging, being the type of woman that she was. You know, she didn't. She was uncompromising. I can imagine my own mother at my show having rolling her eyes and saying it wasn't like that at all, or what the hell are you doing? So, but these are the women they are, and these are the women we're celebrating. People are hungry now, you know, to sort of dig into finding who we are. There's a recognition that it's okay to be yourself, whereas I never felt it was okay to be myself. I always felt there was something a little bit, and I was made to feel it in terms of performance, that I was a little bit too, I had too many opinions. I was told by one very well-known film director, established Irish film director, that I was too intelligent to be an actress. And that was the thinking, you know, It's not really that long ago. So if you're opinionated, if you have a lot of creativity. So I was always driven. I felt I was happier on the outskirts, on the outside. But now I feel the center is porous.
But there is a screen here, which will be.
As part of their first day of rehearsals, Pom Boyd and the rest of the cast and crew are getting introduced to the spaces in which they'll perform. Right now, in the shape of a model of the Theatre Royal, around which everyone gathers.
I'm just going to talk you through, but if you imagine, there will be. There will be a screen here. We have 1950s cigarette girls milling around with programmes, maybe fake cigarettes, and then they there's a curtain. So all of that is really glamorous. It's painted up like a 1950s cinema. There's loads of posters of Constance Smith on the wall. And then when you get closer to...
I'm Emma Fisher, and I'm the set designer on Connie, and I'm here showing the 125 scale model of the set.
Now, when the show is about to start, the cigarette girls move up the stairs, the curtain gets pulled, and they're still in the same sort of painted space, but the wall has started to peel. There's articles and photographs on the wall, but they're also integrated in the wall, and they're peeling. And she's being led.
It's because of where the audience are sitting, it's mainly made of the floor, and the floor is made out of what will hopefully look like earth and ash. It represents the fact that we're in the afterlife. I also wanted it to look like a little bit like a graveyard, and also it represents in the show, because Joanne and Anne collected the earth and the ash from the graveyard where she was marked in on grave. So that kind of fuels the whole design.
There's lighting stands here, here, and here. Some of the lights could be pointed down here. There's two metal bars over.
So they've got a box of earth and ash that was collected from the burial grounds of the unmarked grave of Connie, and it gets told about in the play. And the whole ground is made out of earth and what looks like ash.
Only this space is lit and it is perfectly swept. And Constance is constantly sweeping it and making sure it's perfectly swept. So if an audience member, and we know they will because audience are very unpredictable, don't follow the usher and cut straight through, which one or two of them will bound to do, then you can... You can sweep, you know, clean after them. So it's kind of like this sort of keeping the space perfect. There's no paths at all here.
Next stop for the troupe, walking a couple of blocks away to the venue for the show's Limerick run, the Real Theatre Royal. Part of Joanne Ryan and Anne Blake's dream for their show Connie hinged on getting this disused building back up to code to receive once again a live Limerick audience, just as the Theatre Royal had done in its long history. As the building's former owner explains.
This hallway was built on as part of the Royal Cinema. It was a lane, so they used to queue up here in the lane.
My name is Seamus Flynn. I bought the Theatre Royal from Ward Anderson in 1989. It had been a cinema. You had the first sound movie was shown there in 1930. You had a lot of the famous silent movies were shown there. And it was used for a whole lot of different things. I had often meant to go and look in the archive. Then just one evening it sparked an idea with me. I better go and have a look and see. Could see that it gave me the list of movies that she had appeared in. So then I went to the archive. And lo and behold, her second movie was shown in the Royal. And the rest of the movies, mostly shown in the Savoy, or three or four of the movies definitely were shown around town in that time. Now, she wouldn't have actually been credited on the first couple of movies as actually being in them. But the other ones that she was credited in, she wasn't mentioned in any of the write-ups that I could find. Now, I mean, everybody knew that she was a film star, and that was the, you know, particularly where she was from, up around in Wolfetone Street. My wife, Patricia, is from Wolfetone Street, so she actually would remember her. Coming back there, she could remember what she was wearing and all that, as women do. She was remembering her stepping out of a car and a lot of people on the street and a bit of great excitement and the kerfuffle it created on the street. Patricia would have been very, very young at the time, but there was a large crowd on the street, and she remembered this very elegant lady getting out of a car, and I think she said she had red shoes or But she looked the part. She was a movie star, and she came back to Wolfstone Street as a movie star and played the part of a movie star. So she was known, but she wasn't written up in the archive. The only thing that's in the archive is the actual movies that she starred in. You can imagine back then there was movies were so big, you know. You look at the ads in Limerick. I mean, when you look at, you know, her movies at that stage were playing, the Savoy could hold 1,600 people. So you were getting 1,600 people a night going into those films. So movie stars were big, big news. And she was a movie star.
Having them open and then putting in...
Back inside the Royal, the work continues. The big reveal is having its effect on the cast.
Anyway, if necessary. And then they come round here.
Such
Joanne working with them.
And more tears, not least from co-creator Joanne Ryan.
Holy moly. Or other people crying as well. Yeah, this is a very moving moment, like, for me. It's been so much work, you know, to get it to this point.
Did you hear the audition or no? I'll start
with the first. I'm Catherine Ireton. I'm the vocal arranger and vocal supervisor for Connie. So today is the first day of rehearsals, and I'm just going to do a little bit of singing.
Stay at home, my heart, and rest. Homekeeping hearts.
There is some really lovely musical moments in the show, so I want to relax them and ease them in gently into the music aspect of the show. It is an emotional piece, and I heard a read through back in May, and I was in bits at the end of it. And today I was able to keep it together a little bit more, but I think because it's so real, and that's the thing with singing, when you are really singing and really connecting with yourself and expressing yourself through song, the emotion can carry you away. So that's kind of part of my job, I suppose, in a way, is for the performers to really feel comfortable with that emotion, using it as a tool for the audience to feel that emotion, so they can control that, but they can allow the audience to feel. And that's really the point of live theatre, live music, is so the audience can go away and have really felt something and moved something in themselves.
Stay at home is best, my dear. Lovely, we'll do it again. 2, 3, 4. Stay at home, my heart, and rest. Homekeeping hearts are happiest. For those that wander and they know not where are full of trouble and full of care. To stay.
Yeah, I really have been enjoying working on this because it's meant that I've been arranging the vocals, so I'm at home, figuring out the harmonies and singing myself, and it is great. And actually, it's been a while since I've sung, but I found the days at the end of the day when I've spent my day singing, I just feel so good. There's a lot of release with singing. There's a lot of, you know, I don't know, the world at the moment is a difficult place just to navigate. Even if you don't have something going on in your own life, there's just so much in the world. And singing is a way of really allowing yourself to feel something, express something, get it out. Even the text of the vocals is inviting people to be part of it, I guess. And I suppose especially the finale, the final number, is really about, like, that release, in a way. And for Connie, for everyone to feel a release.
So here on Nicholas Street, we have the... now it's the cinema cafe, but there's no cinema in it. But it harks back to when there was a cinema, the Thomond Cinema, in this spot. and it still has the same facade, the Art Deco facade on it. So it was here when Connie's films were being played in the city, and it's likely that some of them might have been played inside in this cinema, the Thomond. But why we've come onto Nicholas Street, which seems so far away from Wolfchurch Street and the barracks and the railway station, which seems so far from Connie's part of the city, is because of this. Up here on a wall, we have a painting, a mural of a woman with her arms crossed. The woman with her arms crossed is Constance Smith, as she was in the Mudlark movie. The Mudlark was her breakout movie. She played a servant in that, and that's the film that got her spotted by Fox Studios.
What's she doing here? Why are you doing no harm? Come here. Are you daft? Do you want to run into the guard?
I ain't done nothing, honestly.
What are you? A chasing's boy.
So the Mudlark movie was a Rank Studios movie, and it was made in England, and it was seen by executives from 20th Century Fox, who spotted Connie in it playing a maid, and they went, "Ooh, we'll have her," and asked her to sign a 7-year contract and go over to Hollywood to start taking part in movies for 20th Century Fox. She was being paid £100 a week with 20th Century Fox for these movies. But she had starred in a few smaller bits for Ranks before The Mudlark. Some of them, her name wasn't attached to them. But she was definitely, you could see her in the background. She had such striking features. You know, she had such dark hair and such high cheekbones, you couldn't but see her in the background of any scene. So we have her here and on Nicholas Street on the side of the Treaty Brewery. And it's wonderful to see her up here. People who don't know who she is would just see this woman on the side of a building and still not know who she is. But it has a kind of a slightly bitter taste for me, because in her later years, from the 1960s on, she became an alcoholic. And I think having a portrait of her on the side of a brewery is kind of a bit dodge. Connie was a very strong, that's one word that was always used for her. She was a very strong, independently minded woman. When she went over to 20th Century Fox, she kept getting in trouble with producers who wanted to change things about her. They wanted to change her name from Smith, and she was like, "No, that's my father's name. My father's passed away. You're not changing my name." They wanted to change her hair. They wanted to change how she walked. Even though she had been used to having to change how she walked and how she talked when she was in Rank's studio, because the Rank's studio, she was in the Rank's school. And while there, she was taught how to walk with poise. She had to carry the books on her head as she strolled around with other potential stars. But while she was in Ranks in London, they were training her to be an actor. And when she went over to America, they were training her to be a star. You know, and the two of them didn't always cross paths for what they meant in the world.
Fox Studios have terminated their contract with Limerick-born Hollywood starlet Constance Smith, the Irish raven-haired beauty who beat Grace Kelly to the lead role in Taxi and has starred in films The Man in the Attic and The Treasure of the Golden Condor, has been released from her contract by Fox, allegedly for her challenging behaviour on set. Miss Smith has become known for her sparkling aquiline eyes, great gams, and sultry allure.
Constance Smith loses her contract with Fox Studios.
Rising star Constance Smith fired.
Feisty actress gets the axe.
Dublin Dietrich exiled by studio.
The sounds of a city, you have to have seagulls. She ended up becoming a recluse. And she, you know, shunned everybody who'd known her. There wasn't People thought that she had died 20 years before she had actually died. She was that much of a recluse. She ended up living in a council flat in London for the last 20 years of her life. And she died there in the council flat. And the council people came and removed her body. They didn't know who to contact. There was nobody listed as next of kin in any way. And they ended up having her funeral and cremating her without any attendance from anybody because they didn't know who to contact at that point. And her ashes were spread over the Rose Garden in Islington. And it wasn't until after this had happened that her then remaining siblings found out that she had died. And they came, went down to try and get anything that she had left in the apartment, but most of that had been cleared because it was a council apartment, you know, waiting for the next person to come in. So she kind of just faded and disappeared. And there's no headstone, there's no plaque, there's no nothing to say that she was there. She's just amongst the roses. And in the end, I think that's really what she wanted to be, just amongst the roses where nobody would be able to come and point at her or, you know, ask her who she was or leave anything. But that was the end. Poor Connie, bless her. If she wanted to be left on her own in with nobody interfering with her life anymore, and then I come along and start poking at it and pulling little threads and seeing where it came and where it went. But she is so much like family to me. She is, I feel an enormous sense of responsibility to make sure that her life and her story is told in a way that I think that she would have liked, that it wasn't all doom and gloom and sadness and tragedy. You know, she had all these amazing experiences and she fought against so much. You know, she was dealing with so much and fighting her entire life. She was constantly fighting for survival. You know, for a woman of her time put into position that she was, it would have broken a lot more a lot sooner. You know, and the fact that she survived for as long as she did is a testament in itself. I'd like Limerick to just remember her. To remember her. At the moment, there's an event going on inside the Hunt Museum for Richard Harris. And Richard Harris's name is known everywhere in Limerick. And I'd like, if people are talking about Richard Harris, which is great, he's got his statue down on Bedford Row, that they would also in the same breath talk about Constance Smith, talk about the two of them together, about these actors that came from Limerick, that it wasn't just one, that there was more. Perhaps don't give her a statue because we're not very good with statues in Limerick, but definitely remember her.
Well, I'm not getting you very clearly at the moment. Perhaps it's my fault.
He seemed to capture what I had experienced.
You felt that this was your story?
This was my story. And I think most people, if they want to face up to it and don't let's forget about it.
That you can get something across.
Well, I shouldn't want to get anything across. I hope the people will think about before they put the lid on the coffin, as it were.
Connie Gets a Rewrite was presented by Sharon Slater and produced by Luke Clancy. Additional recordings were by Louis Scully, and the programme is a Sounds Doable production for RTE Lyric FM.
The series producer is Owen O'Kelly, and the production coordinator is Michael O'Kane.
And if you know someone who might like to hear that programme, it's available to podcast from the RTE Radio app, from the Lyric website and other podcast platforms. Just search for The Lyric Feature on your preferred platform. The show Connie will run from the 18th of October to the 2nd of November at Limerick's Theatre Royal. You'll find details of that on the Lime Tree Theatre's website. On next week's Lyric Feature, our subject matter is the composer Jane O'Leary, who moved to Ireland from the US over 50 years ago and has played a central role in contemporary classical music in Ireland and particularly in her adopted home in Galway ever since. Jane will be recognised later this month with a Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Concert Hall for her outstanding contribution to Irish music. The Musician That Is Me is our feature next Sunday at 6 p.m. here on RTE Lyric FM.